Welcome to our double seminar on biomedical technology and moral bioenhancement. Our first speaker today is Laurentiu Stăciu, who's going to be talking to us about the rise of post-medicine, some ethical concerns regarding biomedical technology. And we've got quite a lot of time, so after the talk we'll have a lot of time for questions and perhaps a break in between the two talks as well. Okay?
Thank you. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here this morning. As you can see, I'm going to talk about some ethical concerns. I should add some ethical personal concerns about biomedical technology. This is somehow a work in progress, so any comments and suggestions are more than welcome. Now, the idea of this paper started from a conversation, a chat that I had with a friend of mine who at some point he went to a doctor because he has three kidneys and he needs to go to the doctor on a regular basis. And after he came back, he told me that he thinks that doctors have no heart, that they are heartless people. And I was very curious because I knew that he went to a very good doctor in Bucharest. I asked him why. Didn't the doctor treat him well? Didn't the doctor offer him the treatment? And he said, oh no, it was very good. I was feeling much better after I went to the doctor. But I got the feeling that he didn't think that I'm a person. That he thinks that I'm more a problem to be solved. And that made me thinking, and I started to look into this, and this is what I got so far. So I don't have a final conclusion for this this paper. Now, as we all know, today's medicine is more and more a matter of technology. Medical treatments and interventions are assisted by computer, and even medical diagnostics are heavily imbued with technological parameters. Of course, medicine, in a way, has always relied on technology, such as scalpels, probes, and other instruments, but by the start of the 20th century, new instruments were available to study, diagnose, and treat the body. Today, hospitals worldwide use complex computerized machines to image the body, or assist its function. Now, using computers was one of the most important technological advancements in 20th century medicine. They became central to medical care from the 1950s. Computerized machines in hospitals monitored patients continuously, and they also enabled insurers and state-run health services to track patient records on a massive scale. Imaging techniques such as MRI or PET were possible because faster computers could reconstruct images of the body. More diagnostic tests were developed because automated laboratory machines performed tests quicker and more accurately. And this use of machines gave rise to specialist medical practitioners, as we all know. Technology had a major role in medicine becoming more specialized. Many medical technologies allowed specific parts of the body to be studied, diagnosed, and treated. And this led, of course, to doctors who specialized in certain organs, specialized in kidneys, liver, heart, and so on. These include ophthalmologists, doctors specializing in eye conditions, and otolaryngologists, ear, nose, throat specialists. Devices such as the X-ray machine introduced medical professionals such as radiologists and radiographers who were unknown before. But not all new technologies were readily accepted by the medical community. Many were viewed with suspicion, in many cases with severe suspicion, I would add. In the 1930s, for example, some doctors doubted an X-ray image of the chest was as reliable as a physical examination, a person-to-person examination. devices threatened were seen as the as threats to replace the diagnostic expertise of traditional medical practitioners. Many doctors valued their clinical experience over machine-produced information. It may sound very peculiar to you, but we still have this kind of doctors in Romania today who think that machines are something strange. You shouldn't rely too heavily on them. Other technologies failed because doctors or patients found them impractical. ECG was only useful when it became portable and reliable enough to be used at the patient's bedside, because in the beginning this machine was very, very big. But today we even have what's called telemedicine, covering a broad range of medical services from telenursing to telepsychiatry, where doctors offer medical care using information technology to patients from remote places. Now, the use of machines, the use of technology, brought some practical and ethical problems. Safety concerns and costs have limited their use, and still does. Moreover, some historians and physicians argued that machines make doctors poorer healers by encouraging them to focus only on the sick part of the body rather than caring for the patient as a whole, for the patient as a human being, as a person. Many even question whether excessive use of technology within childbirth or to prolong life can be intrusive and do more harm than good. As a side note, it could be said that advancing technology has presented physicians and patients with many other serious ethical dilemmas. For example, ultrasound screens fetuses for disease before babies are born. However, some parents must decide whether to terminate the pregnancy if the fetus is revealed to have a certain condition. So the question arises, does medical technology impose on us more than it empowers? Because this gradual change brought with it a tremendous increase in medical efficiency, and that's a fact. We cannot deny that. But most important, technology also brought about a subtle change of the relationship between patients and practitioners. I would say a certain relativistic shift towards a more fluid ontology. That means that whereas in traditional medicine, doctors and patients were interacting with each other as human beings, persons as patients versus persons as specialists, in today's medicine, this relationship became a relationship between certain technological functions. Patients are medical problems, as I said before, or puzzles. And practitioners, doctors, are complex instruments which guide the solving process of those puzzles. So it could be said that gradually but firmly, technology made us enter into what might be called, the age of post-medicine, which is an age in which we see patients as medical or even scientific puzzles, more or less difficult to solve, of course. Machines whose functioning need the interventions of other machines, especially designed for that purpose. The patient is no longer seen as a person, which is in philosophical jargon, which is a substance, but as a conglomerate of functions and parameters, attributes, which need to be studied thoroughly in order to fix their functioning. And this is the shift I was mentioning before, as an ontological shift. Moreover than not, patients are no longer present in the physician's office, but only their charts and medical computerized data. The patient becomes more and more a set of numbers and measurements, which need to be properly evaluated, rather than a sick person in flesh and blood. Someone might argue that this ontological shift, as I called it, in the relationship between doctor and patient, is not something bad in itself. as long as, of course, it provides more accuracy and efficiency in medical care and medical treatment. And she would be right. If we consider this relationship strictly from a medical point of view, there is nothing wrong with it. There is nothing wrong with changing the way practitioners interact with their patients, which means seeing them as being more machine-like, so to speak, rather than human-like. If this change brings with itself measurable medical benefits. But the question arises again, can we really ever consider this relationship between physician and patient solely from a medical point of view? In other words, are physicians and, of course, patients only that, namely physicians and patients? Because, you see, Hippocratic Oath seems to imply something else. And we have two quotations from that. The first one says, I will remember that there is art to medicine, as well as science, and that worth, sympathy, and understanding may outweigh the surgeon's knife or the chemist's drug. And the second one says, I will remember that I do not treat a fever chart, a cancerous growth, but a sick human being whose illness may affect the person's family and economic stability. My responsibility includes these related problems if I am to care adequately for the sick, which means for the patient. Now, from this point of view, it seems that technological progress brought with itself a huge improvement on the science part, but a smaller one on the art part. It cannot manifest worth, sympathy, and understanding towards a bunch of medical charts and clinical data, that's obvious. Well, to put it in more stronger terms, it seems that in post-medicine, as I called it, patients are, as persons, are slowly but surely disappearing, being replaced by scientific and artificial medical constructs. In short, patients are objectified in the name of precision and efficiency. And this brings us to, as I said, intermediary conclusion, because this is not final, so I may change that in the following months. Whether this subtle and inevitable change, I guess it's inevitable, will end up in a dramatic alienation of the doctor-patient relationship or not, is of course still something open to debate. However, I do believe that we shouldn't wait to see if it would happen or not. We should rather actively try to intervene to influence the direction of this gradual shift towards technology by finding ways to preserve or even improve, if we could do that, the personal character of this very important relationship between doctor and patient and the degree of human qualities involved in medical interactions in general. Now, someone might ask why I use that term, post-medicine. In a way, post-medicine is like postmodernism in philosophy. I think a postmodern philosopher, as we all know, is no longer interested to look for answers for those big questions from philosophical tradition. Questions about truth, about beauty, about justice, and so on. Because he doesn't believe we can find answers to those questions, and he doesn't believe those questions matter. We cannot find a definitive answer to questions about truth. We are always trying to tackle that question from a certain point of view, so that's useless. What really matters for such a philosopher is conceptual edification, as Richard Rorty puts it, through conversations, through discussions. No matter what type of conversation or what kind of discourse we have. Well, in a similar fashion, it seems to me that in what I call post-medicine, the trend is to avoid somehow empathy. Sometimes arguing that empathy towards a total stranger, which is the patient, is not really possible. You cannot have empathy if that person is a stranger to us. We can mimic it, but we cannot have it generally. And to concentrate on helping the patient with all means available, even if, of course, during this process, the patient could be seen as I said, a medical puzzle and not as a human being. And this is the reason I used that term, post-medicine, because I think that there are strong similarities between post-medicine and what is usually called post-modernism, with certain differences, of course. This is all. Now, thank you.
Also from the University of Bucharest, and he's going to be talking to us about how drug patents might lead to disincentives for moral bio enhancement.
This is, the talk is based on a paper co-authored with a friend of mine, appeared some 3 years ago, and actually I blame it on Josh. He said it would be interesting to give this talk, this paper. I'm not sure if the paper got to any of you. In the meantime, I sent it to Josh, but if not, I'd be happy to send it over the email. Some things probably are spelled out in more details in the paper, actually. By and large, I will follow the argument. And I have to say that while this was a work in progress, I presented it 3 years ago, I think, at the first Bucharest-Oxford seminar in applied ethics. And I'm very grateful to you guys for taking the time to come to this discussion. And I'm happy to see some of the authors that were quoted in the paper here and some of the people that appeared in the acknowledgement, because I had many good feedback at the first iteration of the argument. So I start with this thing that I like. It's James Tobin, who was a famous economist, a Nobel Prize winner, met Robert Nozick at a conference, and they had this quite snappy exchange. Tobin explained that Nozick, they were arguing bitterly about an issue. He said, "There's nothing more dangerous than a philosopher who's learned just a little bit of economics." To which Nozick replied with his well-known wit, "Unless it's an economist who hasn't learned any philosophy whatsoever." And this is this story somehow is meant to illustrate part of my stance in this project, in this paper, and as a larger commitment to a sort of argument. So there would be some economic arguments in type here. I will pass quicker through this economic part and hopefully squeeze some interesting moral juice out of the issue. And the issue is, on the topic of moral bioenhancement, I would say I'm a moderate believer, in the sense that at least for some kinds of moral bioenhancement, let's say individual voluntary enhancement, I can't find any compelling objections. While for other types of moral bioenhancement, I would have reservations, but be that as it may, we just assume here, Rado and myself, that becoming a better person is uncontroversially a morally praiseworthy life goal. So I think by and large everybody would agree with that, that we should strive to become better persons. And if tweaking biochemical processes in our bodies proves an effective way of achieving this without harming self or without harming other parties, then we take it as at least as legitimate a means as the morally more traditional forms of moral enhancement. And this is actually just saying that we buy into Julian's and Imar's and Tom's arguments for and other people, for and guys, for bioenhancement. The second assumption that I want going to argue in favor here is that the economic argument regarding the consequences of artificial scarcity induced by intellectual property, at least by the current regime of intellectual property, are correct. So intellectual property gives rise to artificial scarcity, and there are some things that always we should expect when having artificial scarcity. However, we are not assuming that these arguments against intellectual property need to be decisive in any way. Although both Nab and myself, both authors, we don't especially like intellectual property. So the question is, what are the likely consequences? Can we explore some consequences of the current intellectual property framework? And we are only talking about drug patents here. For those individuals who are willing to embark on a process of moral enhancement and are willing to sacrifice scarce resources for achieving enhancement through this biochemical means, right? Who are willing to pay money in order to buy drugs that would help them reach this goal, this objective. And are some of those consequences morally interesting or relevant? And we are only looking, as I said, to at individual and voluntary bioenhancement. I'll quickly run through a few things about intellectual property. And first, we think we need to distinguish between ideal objects on the one hand and their material support on the other hand. And an intellectual property right is a property right in the ideal objects, which are instantiated in the material support. So when you buy a book and the book is copyrighted, you only have a property right over the physical paper. You don't have any, although you bought the book, you don't have any property right over the ideal type, the text that is instantiated in the material support. Differently stated as a paper from 2010 from Laura Byron, she makes this distinction that an intellectual property right is a property right in an ideal type, while more traditional property rights refer to rather to tokens, to particular objects. So types of intellectual property rights, copyrights, patents, trademarks, industrial secrets, and we are only considering here pharmaceutical patents. If needed, I'll come back to this in the discussion. A patent is a property right regarding an invention, a machinery, or a process that has a useful function. And in particular, drug patents are usually property rights either over chemical formulas or over industrial processes leading to the production of that particular drug. What is achieved by a patent? It's actually the holder, which can be the holder, can be the inventor, or can be the company. The holder gets a limited monopoly over the new drug. In effect, the holder of this patent has a right of excluding the others from benefiting or utilizing, without the permission of the holder, the result of the intellectual work. And there might be many justifications in favor of granting this form of property right. There are blockchain justifications, it's a product of my mind, so I should be the owner of that product, etc., etc. But I would say the most common argument, we would say the most common argument rests on a thing that is well known in economics, I mean the importance of incentives. And it goes something like, because the cost of copying an idea is so low, actually, it's close to zero, inventors need to be incentivized. Otherwise, nobody would invent anything. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any sort of creativity. And this limited monopoly granted by patent is a way of incentivizing creativity. As always, with regulations and law, there are unintended and maybe not so much intended consequences. An intended consequence is to give incentives for people to be creative. And why pharmaceutical industry in particular would need this sort of incentive? Because some people would argue it meets the features of what economists call the Schumpeterian industry. Right? Large fixed costs, small and constant marginal costs, and innovation as their most important competitive goal. Let's take a step back now. And we generally talk about property rights, about the emergence of property rights, in a context of scarcity. It's the well-known story in David Hume in Book 3 of the Treatise of Human Nature, where he argues that we need rules of justice and property because resources, things are scarce, and if we don't have rules of property and justice, conflicts over the use of things would appear. And in a more technical approach, so-called economics of property rights or new institutionalist economics would say that the function of property rights is that of internalizing negative externalities. That holds for laptops and glasses and chairs and tables, but does it hold for ideas? I mean, if I have a laptop and Blanca steals my laptop, then I won't have a laptop, she will have a laptop. But if I have an idea, and let's say, can you be the bad guy, please? Yeah. And Blanca steals my idea, I will still have that idea. It's not stealing in the same sense. What happens is that in the world, there would be two persons enjoying that particular good instead of just one person. Okay? So, what's particular about intellectual property is that if traditional property rights over material goods are meant to solve the problem of scarcity, intellectual property rights are meant to induce, to create scarcity. Okay. creating scarcity. Less availability, usually. All other things being equal, higher prices. Always, when that's the basic way of how the law of demand operates. And as a secondary consequence, a decrease in consumption. Particularly for individuals would incur a higher opportunity cost for purchasing that particular thing, that drug. And you could probably now see where the argument is going. Let's skip over the case studies. There are well-documented instances about how drug patents actually lead to huge, steep increases in prices. Like in a study in 2002 in South Africa, see the difference between a patented drug, $1,200 for HIV, while the generic equivalent would be $350. That's like almost four times. And that happens again and again. And probably you can already see where this is going. Straightforward argument from the law of demand would say something like this. If drugs used for moral bioenhancement are patented, and if everything I mentioned earlier holds, then higher prices, artificial scarcity, would lead to a smaller quantity demanded by consumers, by users. So less enhancement, less people becoming better persons. That's straightforward. And I might add, who did those people that whose demand would decrease? The ones that pay a higher opportunity cost. Maybe the not so wealthy persons. But this might be too straightforward problem. And I think it is a bit too straightforward. Because maybe a possible objection would say something like, okay, but drugs for moral bioenhancement are not just any kind of good. They are a special kind of good. They are that kind of good that is unaffected in consumption by changes in pricing. The demand is what economists call inelastic with regard to pricing. There are two ways to put this. These are called usually Veblen goods, after Thorstein Veblen, the first author to have theorized them. And you can say biomoral enhancement drugs like Ritalin, or give me another example. I think Ritalin is actually generic. It's not under patent anymore. I don't know exactly. But maybe they're the sort of positional good like Rolls-Royce cars or fancy cosmetic lines, or I don't know. But if that were true, if that's the actual objection, then we would be okay with that, because it would only show that these sort of drugs would be desired and used mostly by people with enough money to afford positional goods. I mean, if biomoral enhancement drugs are the Rolls Royces of drugs, then we can rest our case here. But maybe there's something else. Maybe there's something so peculiar about morality that would make these drugs a veteran good. Maybe the motivation to attain so strong in people who would volunteer. Let me remind you, we're only talking about voluntary and individual. So maybe the desire is so strong in people who want to become better persons that they will actually disregard price increases. This could be a more promising line of argument, but what would what economists do faced with this sort of argument is look at what's called usually the substitution market. When a particular good becomes unavailable or hugely scarce, you look at the markets for goods that can at least partially substitute the artificially scarce one. And what is the substitute market for moral buying enhancement? It would be the more traditional form of moral enhancement, like education, taking ethics classes. I don't know the situation exactly in Oxford or Madrid, but I wouldn't say ethics courses are the most popular in Romania. We don't rank that bad, but it's not the thing that students flock to necessarily. Other sorts of available services for moral education doesn't seem that people are so hugely interested in that. So we might probably more plausibly say that moral enhancement, bimoral enhancement, occupies different places in the preference orderings of various ages. And it would be quite adventurous to assume that moral enhancement is an existential priority for most individuals. Of course, philosophers might say it should be an existential priority. Maybe it should be an existential priority, but I don't think the kind of data and insights that we have point to being actually an existential priority. So who would be the likely buyer and user of relatively more expensive being drugs? Individuals who strongly, very strongly desire to become morally enhanced, and for various reasons, maybe opportunity cost reasons, efficiency reasons, other kinds of reasons, would see the biological way as the shortest, safest, quickest, etc., etc. But then, in a paper authored by Chris Zerpentine in Neuroethics, he has this phrase, the bad apples problem. And usually an important argument in favor of bioenhancement is that it can help solve this bad apple problem. That's in many books, and in Julian's and Ingmar's, the beginning of the book, is actually the so-called bad apple problem. You know, dictators with available access to weapons, etc., etc. But then the problem would be that if this economic argument holds water, then people who would embark on this project of moral bioenhancement would be people that are already, people that would sacrifice money to become better persons, are people who, by traditional philosophy, are already, in a sense, better persons. Because are those people who strongly desire to become better persons and are strongly committed to embark on this project. I mean, take any substantive account of morality, utilitarian, etc. In any substantive account of morality, you would find something like this. It is important to really want to be a moral person. And if you really want that, you're already higher, in a sense, than a person that does not want to become a better person. It wouldn't be those bad apples that need moral enhancement the most who would sacrifice money in order to get the drugs. It would be the persons that are already projecting themselves in terms of moral improvement. So what? That can be an objection. I mean, the real villains would not buy and embark, would not go willingly to buy a moral enhancement by themselves, so that's not a problem. But we're not talking about the worst apples here. And we think there's still an important range of consequences for, we call them in the paper, the not-so-bad-bad apples. So to see who are the not-so-bad-bad apples, please look at this matrix here. Here we would have potential consumers, wealthy consumers, poor consumers. And I have to say that affluent, non-affluent, is strictly in terms of relative opportunity cost. Not, we don't assume a threshold, a financial threshold. If you earn more than X per year, then you are here. And you can say that they can have a desire to embark on a moral enhancement project, a prima facie desire, for example, or that they are willing to consider embarking on this sort of project. And somewhere over here would be those really bad apples who don't care about it. And they wouldn't do anything anyway. But now imagine this sort of scenario. Imagine this Joe guy who knows something about himself, who knows that he can become quite violent when drinking. And he's not an alcoholic. That happens very, very rarely. But he knows that when it happens, he can become a danger to his family. And we chose this example because in Romania we still have huge problems with both domestic violence and alcoholism, mostly in villages, mostly in the rural part of Romania.
Right.
Imagine this Joe. He knows he has this problem. And one morning he looks at a paper or zaps the TV and hears about a drug that inhibits violence. Severe. And he says, things okay. Then that's a sort of extra precaution that I can take. What he did before in the scenario is avoid as much as possible any kind of triggering context. So any context in which drinking would be appealing, going out with colleagues, etc. But he says, I can take this extra precaution because I haven't been always successful in the past in avoiding this triggering context. And I'll put this Joe into, would Joe buy that drug? One thing we can say is that the cheaper the drug, the most plausible it is for Joe to buy the drug, of course. But it's not the only thing that we can say. We can say that it becomes, on the one hand, a matter of rational balance, because he could argue, he could say, well, I know this is a risk, but it never happened until now. And he's a non-F1 Joe, and instead of sacrificing this money in order to buy the drug as an extra precaution, I would rather invest the money, I would rather spend the money to provide better food for my children. I would rather spend the money to get them a better education. Why would I spend the money to inhibit my residence? So let's say that the effects of artificial scarcity, price increase, drug patents would be largely unimportant for affluent Joes, let's say. If affluent persons with a strong desire to become better persons, then probably an increase in price would not change consumption in any way. For those willing to consider, maybe if they're the kind of moral snobs that would buy moral enhancement drugs because they are the equivalent of Rolls Royces, then it's still okay. But here, our job can fall either here or there with the same, with important differences, but with a even more important similarity. They would be less inclined under artificial scarcity to invest, to divest rather their resources into moral bioenhancement. And this does not affect, as I said, the really the worst apples we can imagine. But it would affect the incentives for moral bioenhancement for those people that are reasonable and plausible target for this. I mean, average Joes who would want to become better persons, would be in a certain state of the world willing to spend resources in order to become better persons, but who still have to prioritize spending those resources over other things. And the way agents prioritize relate to their to their subjective hierarchies of priorities, always. Well, this is the weak version, is what we think we have argued in the paper, that drug patents provide some disincentive, at least for voluntary moral bioenhancement. And we think this is supported by the argument. And maybe there's a moral import of a moral juice to be squeezed out of this argument. We hope at some point to write a second paper arguing for a considerably stronger thesis, that one cannot be consistently both a supporter of moral bioenhancement and a supporter of the current configuration of intellectual property rules. But we are still quite a long way from getting there. Maybe we won't ever get there. We would like to. I'm not sure we can get there. So, yeah.